I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. President Trump was in Cincinnati for a rally last night, but it appears that he left his heart and his vitriol in San Francisco, Baltimore, and virtually all major cities in America. The July job numbers released this morning are encouraging, but Congressman Will Hurd of Texas isn't encouraged. The only black Republican member of Congress has announced he will not seek re-election next year. 20 Democrats who are seeking election to the presidency squared off in Detroit this week. Frontrunners Biden, Harris, Sanders, and Warren drew attacks, as did Barack Obama. Go figure. Julie Bykowitz of The Wall Street Journal and Franco Ordonez of NPR join me with a look behind the headlines. Plus, a new exhibition at the Maryland Historical Society explores the allure of looking at ourselves. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. It's the Midday News Wrap. Job numbers for July were released this morning. 164,000 new workers were added. It's not too bad, but the numbers for May and June were revised downward. Unemployment remains low at 3.7%, and wages are tipping up a little, but overall the U.S. economy is shrinking. The president says that in a few weeks he will add a number of consumer products to the list of things that are subject to tariffs from China, while insisting incorrectly that China pays those tariffs. In fact, American consumers will pay more for everything from cell phones to vacuum cleaners as long as the tariffs are in place. In a statement to the Baltimore Sun, Congressman Elijah Cummings confirmed reports that early last Saturday morning, an intruder broke into his home in Druid Heights. Mr. Cummings said that his home alarm went off, the congressman yelled at the intruder, and the person left. Governor Larry Hogan was installed as the chairman of the National Governors Association this week. Among local and state officials defending Baltimore and Representative Cummings from President Trump's continuing verbal assault, Mr. Hogan's response has been among the most tepid. The president kept Baltimore in the national news with tweets and comments all week and with pointed comments about our city and other urban centers at a rally in Cincinnati, Ohio last night. He also made specious and unfounded claims about the theft and waste of billions of dollars worth of federal grants by city officials. And as the national media covered what Fox News is calling the Battle of Baltimore, Democratic presidential hopefuls held two debates that were at once full of substantive ideas and more than a little personal sniping. Divisions between the progressive and moderate wings of the party were laid bare, as was perhaps the desperation of some of the lesser-known candidates who clearly fear being excluded from the next round of debates next month. Particularly on Wednesday night in the second debate, the candidates who are polling near the bottom of the list were in large measure responsible for most of the attacks on frontrunners Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Joining me today for the Midday News Wrap to chat much more amiably than the Democratic presidential candidates did are Franco Ordonez. He's an NPR White House correspondent who joins us on the line from NPR in Washington. Franco, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
And Julie Bykowitz, a national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who is with me here in Studio A. Good to see you, Julie.
Nice to see you.
So, Julie, let me start with you. You were in Detroit. You were in the room for the debates. Being in the room is always a different experience than watching it on television. What was your take about both nights, Tuesday and Wednesday?
Great. I wish I was in the room. They always put the press adjacent to the room, but we were close enough. It was a really beautiful theater, Fox Theater in Detroit. 3,800 people in the audience. The press was right next door in a building. And so we got, the whole sort of swarm of candidates and their aides coming over to spin, of course, right after the debate. And no surprise, everyone thinks that their candidate won. But what was interesting is I feel like the two nights could be the headline for me. For each night was the first time was there really wasn't any daylight between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders on night one. And that was sort of the big question going into the night is would having those two on the same stage really highlight for people policy differences or approach differences in their vision? And they didn't take the bait on that. You know, moderators really tried within the sort of strange format to get them to kind of snipe at each other, but they didn't take the bait. Now, on the other hand, the headline from night two, I think, was it's everybody versus Joe Biden. That really came through again and again. At one point, I lost track of how many different candidates on the stage had directly, you know, sort of turned to him and attacked him, you know, in varying ways. Some were sort of friendly approaches. Cory Booker, Senator Booker from New Jersey, tried a little bit of a sort of more jovial attack, if you can even say that. But Senator Kamala Harris and others were very pointed. But he was prepared. So it was an interesting sort of dynamic on that second night.
Yeah, most folks think he did much better this time around than he did in the first series of debates. Franco Ordonez, your take on the difference between the tone of Tuesday and Wednesday night. They struck me as pretty substantially different. It seemed like a very different vibe on Wednesday.
Yeah, I would agree with both, you know, both you and Julie about, you know, I, you know, the first debate to me was very much, you know, about the different tensions between the progressive and the moderate candidates, how everyone seemed to be against Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Unlike in a different way than the earlier debates, you know, there was more of a divide between the moderates and the progressives, whereas last time, you know, there was so much kind of unity around decriminalizing of the border, or more unity about decriminalizing the border, and more unity about providing all of those in the country illegally healthcare. I thought there was a lot more outspokenness against those things from some of the more moderate candidates. On day two, as Julie mentioned, it was very largely, you know, attack Joe Biden. It seemed like almost so many of the members just took a signal from Kamala Harris from the first debate and said, oh, look at all the airtime that she received for attacking Joe Biden. Let's try to take that strategy and do it here in Detroit. And it seems like that's what they did. And, you know, it worked for Cory Booker. Certainly he got a lot of airplay out of it. And, you know, others like Castro have also gotten a few viral hits.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, and former presidential candidate on the show a couple days ago, and I asked him if he could parse the difference between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and it kind of stumped him for a little bit.
Oh, wow.
And what
okay.
he came up with was, well, Bernie Sanders is a Democrat for, you know, a couple of months every 4 years when he's running for president, and Elizabeth Warren is a Democrat all the time. Of course, Mr. O'Malley has endorsed Beto O'Rourke. When it comes to the format, the folks at CNN have really taken a big hit on this, Julie. I mean, it seems like an awful lot of people are disconcerted about the way they gin this up and the nature of the questions. There's very differing percentages of FaceTime that each of the candidates got, and that people are complaining about that. What was your take on the way the questions were formulated and the sort of combative scene that CNN appeared to be trying to establish?
You know, I just wonder how much anyone who's watching these debates is learning about any of the candidates. If you tried to follow the healthcare policy debate at the top of night two, I mean, I follow this stuff pretty closely. I suspect a lot of your listeners do as well. But I just absolutely got lost in the sort of weeds and minutiae and sort of calling out one another's little nitpicking of pieces of plans. And I'm just not sure at this very early stage what drilling down like that does, and especially when combined with the format of abrupt cutoffs from the moderators. It's like you just start to explain your plan or sort of how you've come up with this plan and your time is up. So I think that it's not entirely CNN's fault. Certainly they were very open about baiting candidates into directly engaging with one another. But when you have 10 candidates on a stage and two nights of it, I think that in itself, I'm not sure who could do a good job with that. I think it's sort of degrees of bad at this point. And really what will move this primary forward is having a debate stage with fewer people on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know when we get there, because I was just doing a head count of what's in store for us in September in Houston. And I think we have 8 confirmed candidates
who
will be on
that. Who have met the bar for
yeah,
the next
so,
time.
So I'm not sure if that means they'll try to split them up into two smaller stages, or what will happen?
The Times is reporting, New York Times is reporting this morning that if there's fewer than 10 or fewer, they'll do all of them in one night.
So
it'll be still 10. I mean, it'll be as many as we've just had these last couple times. And Franco, how about you? Were there questions that you would have asked that didn't get asked, or questions that you would have phrased in a dramatically different way? I know I had a few for me, but what was your take?
I mean, I agree. It did have kind of like this survivor type feel. I certainly would have liked to have heard more from, you know, some of the candidates about how they wanted to explain their healthcare proposals. I mean, it kind of felt like, you know, please describe your healthcare priorities, and I'm going to give you 15 seconds to do it.
Yeah.
It was extremely difficult to follow. On the one hand, I do feel like this format did prevent the candidates from kind of getting into long-winded answers. It kept them on their toes. It kept their answers sharp. They certainly seemed to get more in the rhythm as the debate went along. The beginning was extremely abrupt, was, you know, jarring, but I think it improved as we went along. You know, as Julie said, it's not entirely CNN's fault. They certainly played into this. But the party, you know, also had its role by, you know, kind of setting the bar so low so that so many people could be on that stage. The moderators had to get to all of these people or try to be fair to as many as possible. So it is kind of like a no-win situation.
Yeah.
It really is.
Hank Stuver in The Washington Post wrote about it, saying the overall tone was cable news alarmism. And I did get that sense of it. And what discouraged me was, instead of saying, you know, Senator Harris, what is your plan for health care? How do you insure the most people at the lowest cost? It was, what's wrong with Senator Sanders' health plan? You know, and I just think the way you phrase it means a lot. And then, of course, we have both Joe Biden and Michael Bennett from Colorado saying at one point it would cost $3 trillion for Senator Harris's plan. And then next sentence, it was $30 trillion. I mean, it gets it gets crazy. Is it, Julie, you've covered a bunch of presidential campaigns. Mm-hmm. Is it a zero-sum game for the candidates who are worried about not being invited the next time around? Do they have any other option in terms of the common wisdom about how to run for president than, other than tearing somebody else down to lift themselves up?
I mean, that's certainly the most sort of likely route to staying relevant and staying viable. But I think that I am extremely interested in what happens over the course of this month. Because I think it's on some of these candidates to really self-reflect and evaluate whether they should be in the race. You know, if your message, no matter how hard you're working, is just not resonating, I think you might want to look internally and say, why am I doing this? I mean, the person that leaps to mind for me is John Delaney. I mean, the man has not had a job other than running for president for 2 years.
Yeah, he started a year before anybody else.
And he has lived in Iowa that whole time, and he has virtually...
He's, of course, a former congressman from here.
Yeah, I know. I guess it's a little bit sensitive here in Maryland, but he just really does not have anything to show for it in the polling, in his donor support. Of course, he's largely self-funding, so he hasn't had to rely on donors. But, you know, to me, small donors are also sort of not only a way to fund your campaign, but evidence that your message is resonating. So you've got a lot of people like him. I don't mean to pick exclusively on him, but there are a lot of people kind of in that same sort of, you know, wheelhouse that, you know, I'm not sure what the Democratic Party does if these guys just hang around and sort of kind of stick with it as long as possible.
Or you have a guy like Tom Steyer who enters way later than anybody else. And Franco, you cover the White House. What does the staff at the White House have to say about this? How do you gauge the president's reaction to these now two sets of debates that have taken place so far?
I mean, in many ways, they're enjoying it. I mean, certainly you're getting the expected kind of press releases and statements that, you know, the president has won. But it does, in many ways, what is happening in the debates. And as with so many Democrats on stage trying to differentiate themselves, trying to get, in many ways, get left of the other one, it kind of plays into the narrative that President Trump and his aides have kind of established, and his campaign aides, that this party, the Democratic Party, has kind of gone farther and farther left. Trump made the, you know, the joke at the rally that, you know, last night, that he took fewer hits than Barack Obama. And it's kind of amazing that Barack Obama's policies are being questioned as much as they are from the Democrats right now. But this is the state of the Democratic Party at the moment.
And before we go to a break, Franco, Mr. Trump does have a Republican opponent in the primary, Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts. Is there any chance that the Republican Party would condone a debate between Mr. Weld and Mr. Trump?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think the Republican Party is so on board with President Trump that it seems like there is going to be very little to absolutely no resistance to President Trump and his efforts. I mean, he has at this point just such power over Republicans, and we're just seeing it, you know, left and right with the, you know, with the attacks on minority members, on the attacks on you know, Democratic cities, that we're not hearing from Republican leaders. So for them to kind of go out and support a candidate that has little to no chance or no chance at all is not unlikely.
Franco Ordonez covers the White House for NPR. Julie Bykowitz is a national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I'm Tom Hall. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap after a quick break. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, trauma in Baltimore and what we can do to address it. Baltimore City Council members Zeke Cohen and Christopher Burnett talk about a bill that they're pushing at City Hall that would make Baltimore a trauma-responsive city. Plus, Erica Bridgeford, one of the co-founders of Baltimore Ceasefire 365, joins me to talk about this weekend's ceasefire events. That's coming up Monday on Midday. And coming up on the show a little later today, an exhibition of photography at the Maryland Historical Society explores our fascination with ourselves. We'll talk to the show's curators in just a little bit here on Midday. But first, let's get back to the Midday News Wrap. Franco Ordonez is one of NPR's White House correspondents. Before joining NPR, he wrote about diplomatic affairs, foreign policy, and immigration as a correspondent in Cuba, Colombia, Mexico, and Haiti. Julie Bykowitz is a national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She has covered presidential elections and the White House for Bloomberg News and the Associated Press. She was also a reporter for the Baltimore Sun for a bit a few years ago. You are welcome to join our conversation. We'll try to sneak in some calls at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR, and you can follow me on Twitter. Always a good idea, @TomHallWYPR. Let's go to the phones to Brian in Baltimore. Brian, welcome to Midday with Julie Bykowitz and Franco Ordonez.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. I believe we really live in strange times. I have major concerns and problems with the president gloating and mocking that Representative Cummings' house was robbed. I see it as a form of presidential intimidation on congressional members who do any kind of serious investigation or make serious comments of his policies or practices. You know, I see it as a form of trying to break down the different branches of government other than the executive branch.
Well, thanks for that comment, Brian. I think your sentiments are shared by many, many people. I mean, Franco, for example, a day or two ago, the president accused Baltimore of stealing billions of dollars of federal aid. Fox News reported that Baltimore has received $16.9 billion in federal aid. The Baltimore Sun saying that, according to the government's own list, it's much, much less than that, by more than by half. It's sort of hard to know how to parse it all out. I'm sure they're both referring to different time periods or different kinds of studies, but does the White House staff have any concerns about the president bashing not just Baltimore now, but as of last night in Cincinnati, he's virtually bashing every metropolitan urban area in the country?
Yes. You know, there are staff members, certainly factions of the White House, who are very concerned about this, you know, I don't know if you would call it a strategy, but certainly these attacks of major cities. But Trump is not backing down. Trump is not one to back down. He just continues to attack, to attack, to attack. You know, we've heard this over and over again. You know, from him, from former press secretary Sarah Sanders, from his wife. You know, his wife, you know, during the campaign would say if her husband is attacked, he will punch back 10 times harder. So as we have seen there, you know, it's not uncommon for his staff to be, you know, worried or concerned about things that the president is saying. But we can be assured that President Trump is not going to back down in light of controversy. I mean, he joked yesterday about how he didn't want to start controversy, almost seemed to be feeding this kind of turmoil. And, you know, he seems to like it.
Yeah, it's an old joke of his. He's used it at several rallies. And Julie Bykowitz, as President George W. Bush would say, when it comes to strategery, this is really quite puzzling. I mean, are you one of those folks that buys this explanation that this is an intention to distract from other things that people are paying attention to? For example, Chairman Cummings, as the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, who last Thursday subpoenaed phone records and WhatsApp records and email records of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. And there are those who think, well, this is very purposeful and strategic on President Trump's part, and that he's trying to make sure that folks don't think about that.
No, I don't buy that. I think it's gut level politics. I think we're in an era where we're really sort of exposed to how vulnerable the system is to people who don't adhere to what is traditionally thought of as decorum, you know, just common decency and politeness and things that seem quote unquote presidential. And so that's why the media and the public in general and Congress, obviously, are so flummoxed by this whole thing. It's just, we just really have not experienced a time when the White House is led by someone who just doesn't care about decorum. And whether it's good or bad, time will tell in terms of, you know, sort of lasting impacts on the system. But it has definitely revealed that the system has been built on and relies on type of decorum that if you have someone in there who doesn't follow it, you're very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you're not sure what to do.
Yeah. And Franco, one of the things that's really caught my attention and has disconcerted me is that a lot of folks in our business are framing this Twitter storm and these comments by the president as a feud between Mr. Trump and Chairman Cummings. And it doesn't seem to me it's between those two guys at all. Mr. Cummings has been very reticent. He has not said virtually anything about Mr. Trump's tweets. It's not as if they're going back and forth and, you know, calling each other names. This is all coming from Mr. Trump and the White House. In terms of how people are perceiving it and how you think Mr. Trump is perceiving it, do you think, you know, that he is simply playing to his base? He doesn't care whether the cities like him or not because they didn't vote for him the last time and they're not going to vote for him this time? Is he just written off cities?
I mean, certainly there's no question that he is fueling the fervor of his base. But, you know, Chairman Cummings is, you know, chair of the committee that is conducting many of these investigations. You mentioned the investigations of emails and texts, personal emails and texts of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner. It was only a few days Trump, you know, start his, you know, his his Twitter attacks against Elijah Cummings and Baltimore. In those tweets, he specifically stated that Democrats like Elijah Cummings should be more focused on their communities instead of focusing on him and the so-called, his words, witch hunt. That said, you know, President Trump is very good at picking opponents that he can fight against. Corey Lewandowski, his campaign manager back, during the campaign or early, the early days in 2015, once told us that one of President Trump's greatest assets is his ability to grab a foil, to pick a foil, whether it's Elizabeth Warren and calling her Pocahontas, attacking the media, now attacking the squad, the four minority congresswomen. And Elijah Cummings seems to be like another one of those where he can kind of get this us versus them. And he seemed to, last night, he added the Democratic cities. It's, it's fascinating.
That's Franco Ordonez. He's one of NPR's White House correspondents. Julie Bykowitz is here as well. She's a national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can also tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Let's go to the phones to Dan in Baltimore. Dan, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, I was saying, so many of the candidates on the debate spoke as if the as presidents, they would immediately be able to do, they would do something immediately. When what is required, they all would need working majorities in both houses of Congress, and then the third thing. I believe it was the governor of Washington who said that
Jay
one
Inslee.
Of the major things they would have to do is get rid of the filibuster. Even if they won the Senate, the Republicans could still control things as long as the filibuster rule, which is just a Senate rule, not part of the of a constitutional rule. And I was just...
Yeah, thanks for that comment, Dan. I appreciate it. Julie, when you talk to folks in the campaigns in Detroit, there's pressure on some of them, Governor Hickenlooper, for example, in Colorado, to run for the Senate against Cory Gardner, where Democrats think that that's a gettable seat. Are you hearing that kind of talk and hearing talk about other mechanics other than the presidential level, as our caller is alluding to?
Absolutely. I think that it is, the caller had a great point there with pointing out that it's not like the candidates will be able to do a lot of these things that they say on day one without support from Congress and the Senate. And so it's important not to lose sight of sort of the overall political picture. And certainly House Republicans have had a rough run recently, with more and more announcing retirements. I'm not sure, maybe if Franco knows how many we're up to, but it's been a really significant number who have decided not to run again in pretty vulnerable seats. And so, at least at the House level, Republicans should be sort of nervously eyeing the political landscape. You're not hearing as much about the Senate makeup yet. But I think that's going to just continue to grow. It's obviously a more expensive endeavor, so it's difficult to lure good candidates into those races, knowing it's, 30, 40, $50 million races. And that's a heck of a lot of money to raise. But it is important to not only think about the presidential election for the presidency, but what impact it has on bringing out all of those voters. And in certain states where, Senate seats could flip, House seats could flip.
Yeah. And Franco, San Antonio, El Paso congressman by the border, Will Hurd in Texas, he's the only black Republican. He announced just last night that he does not intend to run for office in 2020. I think that brings us up to 9 in the Congress, if my number is right. Has the White House had any reaction to, a minor exodus from Congress of Republicans?
Not that I've seen at this point. I mean, certainly that will be a question that will be posed to the president next time, you know, we have a chance at a departure or arrival. You know, it was certainly big news when as we were watching the debate, you know, the Will Hurd announcing that he will not run again was certainly the thing that was grabbing more attention than, pardon me, not the debate, but the rally was capturing more attention than the rally itself. You know, being the only Republican, African-American Republican in the House, as well as someone who is seen having tried to work on both sides. But I think this is the reality of the House right now. And there's certainly, you know, many Republicans, as Julie said, who are, you know, questioning whether they should stick it out.
Let's go to David in Baltimore on the phone. David, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for taking the call. 2 points I have to make. First of all, what kind of person sees a person in trouble or a city in trouble or a country in trouble, and their first reaction is to kick them while they're down and abuse them and beat them up as badly as they possibly can? Somebody with the total lack of decency of Donald Trump, or just a reprehensible man. The second thing is related to that. The point of the debates for me is all about figuring out who can actually beat Donald Trump. Any one of those candidates' plans is going to be better than what Donald Trump is doing to destroy healthcare in the country, to destroy the environment, to enrich his supporters. And so I'm looking at who's got the guts and the ideas that can really put Donald Trump in his place and get rid of him forever from this country.
All right. Thanks for the comment, David. Julie, when you talk to folks from the campaigns, when you're out there in Detroit, are they all making sure that they assert their path to victory?
Well, you know, to be honest, I did see a little bit less of that during this debate than perhaps I was expecting. And it sort of has exposed a split among Democratic strategists as to what is important to talk about right now. You know, certainly with no clear runaway front runner, lots of caveats there, but Joe Biden certainly is leading in polling, but he's not at a level where you could just sort of guarantee that he's going to be the nominee. What you see is that the candidates who are not Joe Biden are very interested in drawing contrast, particularly with him as the front runner, and differentiating themselves. And that's a true primary that's going on. But on another level, people who are backing Joe Biden, or people who are sort of seeing him as the likely nominee, would love to move the conversation to a more Trump-focused, you know, general election style argument, even in this primary. I find that very interesting. And I think that it'll be interesting to see if there's any sort of overcorrection in Houston next month when all the candidates get back on the stage. And maybe we do hear almost exclusively about Donald Trump this time.
Yeah, and as Franco mentioned, it was really kind of jarring to hear people taking on Barack Obama in a way more so than they did Mr. Trump in that particular debate. And Franco, there's a bunch of other news during the week. But for example, Mr. Trump has nominated a congressman from Texas, John Ratcliffe, to replace Dan Coats as the head of the director of national intelligence. What's the reaction out on the, you know, did he mention that last night in the rally? I watched some of the rally. I didn't watch all of it. And what is the White House saying about the criticisms that Mr. Ratcliffe is undergoing?
Well, I mean, not surprisingly, the White House is defending Ratcliffe for this position. President Trump has said this week that he was considering, you know, Representative Ratcliffe for a while, long before the Mueller hearing, where, you know, so many of us, you know, heard, you know, the congressman kind of go on the attack against the special counsel as he kind of discussed his investigation of Russian meddling. You know, certainly John Ratcliffe had, you know, many viral moments from that, and that certainly seemed to catch not only the public's attention, but certainly from our sources, you know, it was, you know, appreciated by President Trump. You know, President Trump after called those members of Congress like John Ratcliffe, who went on the attack against Mueller patriots, and said they were defending the country. So not surprisingly, you have senators like Chuck Schumer saying that, you know, that was a loyalty test and this is only a political position. And, you know, there is, you know, there is some legitimate criticism, of course, of Ratcliffe because he does not have the kind of experience that many, you know, go into this position. He did not work in the intelligence community. He prosecuted some terrorism cases as a prosecutor, but he has not served in the intelligence community or worked in this area for at all, really.
And Julie, when we look ahead to the next round of debates in Houston for the Democrats, as we mentioned, if there are 10 or fewer, it's going to be on one night. If there's more, they'll divide them up. But there are, by the New York Times count, 8 candidates, mm-hmm. Senator Amy Klobuchar,
today,
who qualify. When they talk about, because you cover money in politics mm-hmm. in particular, when the campaigns talk to you about their efforts to raise money, it must be difficult in a field of 20 people asking all the same people for money. I mean, how are they doing this?
Well, they're doing it through a lot of emails, growing supporter lists whenever they can. And they do that by advertising on Facebook. They do it by putting out emails where they ask people to tell their friends to sign up for lists. And then, you know, they certainly don't always make a direct financial ask. But once you get your name on a list, you just sort of get pummeled with emails reminding you that this person needs your help. And having the donor threshold set by the Democratic National Committee as a trigger for getting on the debate stage has been really interesting to watch.
I think for coming up by August 28th,
they have
to show 130,000 unique donors, uh-huh. different people.
And so that's already been achieved by, you know, as we've pointed out, by 8 people. And then there are a cohort of people who are pretty close. And so we'll hear lots from them in the month of August through social media and doing television appearances and so forth, trying to get people to even just give a dollar. And that's been the strategy for a lot of them, like Senator Booker comes to mind. It's not that they're necessarily leaning on those donors for the bulk of their fundraising. They're just, you know, trying to get the sheer number of donors. So you literally will have presidential candidates asking you for a single dollar just because that's just as valuable in some ways as if you give the maximum $2,800.
Because that makes you a unique donor.
Exactly.
Yeah, a unique donor. Franco, is the White House assuming Mr. Biden is going to be the opponent in the fall in the general election? For a while, it seemed that was the case. I noticed while I was watching the rally last night that Tucker Carlson seemed to single out Kamala Harris as the likely nominee. And I wonder if that was in concert with what Mr. Trump is thinking about.
Well, certainly last month, President Trump was talking about how he thought that Joe Biden was likely the leader of the pack. You know, this week, he seemed to kind of back off that a bit and say he sees about 4 candidates that will kind of who are emerging. You know, from my sources at the White House and those who are close, they certainly are concerned about Joe Biden, and they see him as the, if not the, certainly one of the most challenging people that they would face in a general election because of his appeal in Midwestern states and other parts of the country that President Trump has been able to kind of win over from Democrats. You know, Joe Biden certainly is a formidable challenger, but, you know, as we've been discussing today, he faces a long road to go, and he's got a lot of people nipping at his heels.
Franco Ordonez is an NPR White House correspondent. Franco, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Julie Bykowitz is a national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She focuses on money and influence in politics, and your influence on me is unmeasurable because you are always terrific, you and Franco,
well,
both
thank
with
you.
So many great things to say.
Thank
so
you.
Thank you so much. We'll see you next
Appreciate
time, I hope.
It.
Okay. Coming up next, Joe Trpea and Elena Volkova join me to talk about the fascination that we all have with looking at ourselves. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Jonathan Bolin was a star high school quarterback.
The first play, they hiked the ball to John. He went straight down the middle and scored a touchdown.